The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week it's going to be the turn of the American singer, guitarist. It's the one and only Talia Sadek, who I spoke to very recently to find out more about life, love and poetry. Was in various bands as well as a prolific solo career, but was in people like Live Skull, Codeine, Come and various other bits and pieces. But anyway, you're going to find out more about that in this interview, and as I said, she's also done a lot of solo work. So this is the interview. After several minutes of interesting but casual chat that we edit out, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. Talia, it's over to you.
Yeah, definitely. I think for me it was probably Patti Smith, hearing Patti Smith on the record radio for the first time, probably in maybe even like in 76 or 77. I think it was Gloria.
Yeah. Right.
Gloria. Yeah. And
yes.
And then Discovering Horses, and kind of simultaneously with that, I was, you know, discovered the Ramones and some other sort of, you know, original punk bands, The Clash and Generation X. But I think, yeah, Patti Smith was probably a really big one for me.
A big moment. Yeah, it was funny because at the weekend I did an interview with a performance artist and person called Penny Arcade, and she spoke a lot about her time in New York and being with Patti Smith a bit. So, yeah, it was quite a nice little connection. Were your parents at all, did they have any kind of musical interest or cultural interests that possibly shaped you or sort of gave you some sort of inspiration or something to rebel against? It's a fine line.
Not really. I mean, I have to say, neither of my parents really played an instrument or sang or did any kind of organized stuff, but they were definitely really, really big aficionados. They really loved music, and music was very important to them. I've come to realize, sort of like as I've, you know, grown older and gotten to know them, probably when I was, you know, a teenager, I didn't really realize it. But, you know, now that knowing them as an adult, I was like, wow, you know, I think it was really, really one of their, a huge part of their life. But I wouldn't say my immediate family was a particularly like musical oriented family, though not against it. You know, and we had a piano that I don't even know why we got it. I think at some point there was an idea that me and my brother or my brother would like learn to play, and it just kind of like stayed in the basement. But no one was really too good.
Yes,
at it.
No one sort of bashed away. Because
yeah.
That's often one. The other thing is an older brother or sister who had a sort of musical kind of taste. I mean, I was the youngest of three. I must admit, my middle brother didn't really, he wasn't that into music. But my older brother, who was 7 years older, he was kind of a big, you know, influence on my life. So he had that world of glam rock. Not glam rock, prog rock. God, he loved prog rock in the 70s. So that was his thing. And I remember, you know, being kind of fascinated with these records that he had that he forbid me to play. So obviously I sneaked into his room and would play them and became quite obsessed with the work of, you know, Yes and Genesis and all those people, which, you know, I enjoyed at the time that discovery. But now I look back and think, God, if only he'd had better music taste, it would have been so much more fun. But it was all right, you know. Prog was definitely not some punk. He was definitely something he didn't ever sort of like. So that never came into our lives. So then as the sort of 70s progressed, obviously you mentioned Patti Smith and the Ramones. So punk, I guess you were the right age for punk. I was a bit too young for that first wave, really.
Yeah, I was probably like, I don't know, I'm guessing like 15 or something like that when the first wave kind of happened. And was I 15? Yeah, that's 15, maybe 16, somewhere around there. And a friend of mine, had a friend, Azalea Snail. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's a musician. She's gone on to do a lot of different things. And she was a year ahead of me. She was 1 year ahead of me in high school. And I kind of saw her wearing a Patti Smith t-shirt in high school one day. And she would always dress all in black. And I'd never didn't know anyone else that really knew about Patti Smith. And I became friends with her. And she was one of those kids that, like, you know, she got all the magazines and she had all these imported singles. And she just turned me on to so much stuff, like X-Ray Specs. And I remember listening to like the singles in her bedroom, you know, after school, The Day the World Turned Dayglow and stuff like that. So, yeah, so I was lucky that I had a guide who really turned me on to a lot of stuff, because my brother, older brother, like yours, was really into prog rock, which I was definitely not into at all. So,
yes.
Not listen to his records, but I was forced to listen to his records because we only had one turntable in our house and my brother was usually monopolizing it. But, through my friend in high school, I became familiar with a lot of the punk bands. And, also I grew up in DC and also just outside DC, kind of like my earlier years were in the center of the city. And then my adolescent years were just outside in a very close suburb. And DC had actually quite a big punk scene, which I discovered. And, at the time, you only had to be 18 to get into clubs, and it's pretty easy as a 16-year-old to, you know, get away with it. So it was like, I actually started going into town, into DC, and going to punk rock clubs when I was like 16 years old, and seeing all sorts of bands like the Ramones and the Cramps used to play in DC a lot, and I saw Patti Smith a bunch of times. So yeah, we would get a fair amount of the New York bands, and also like back in 79, it's kind of making a comeback now, but I got the original like No New York, the sort of like that had already kind of started around 79, the noise stuff. And yes, so it was interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Cause I it's going to be interesting. The punk scene in America, New York compared to the UK is quite different really. Cause there was it Z Records that had that kind of no wave sound with people like, was it Liquid and.
I don't know about that. Like when I was in DC in that era, Stiff Records was really huge in England.
Right. Yes.
If you remember them, they had Lena Lovitch and just a ton of bands. And so DC we had Limp Records, which was kind of like, you know, Stiff and Limp. And that put out all the punk rock bands like, oh God, there was the Nurses and the Razz and the Deceits and, the Slicky Boys and the Urban Verbs. I mean, it was kind of like a little bit maybe more new wave-ish, but there's a band called the Shirkers and yeah, they were all on Limp Records, which was based on this record store called Yesterday and Today that was in Rockville, Maryland. And yeah.
Yes, God, I need to check that out, don't I? That sounds like a sort of Limp Records. Yes, that does sound good. So when you got to sort of like 78, 79, you hadn't been in a band by then, but obviously you were getting quite excited. What was the sort of the moment that you felt like you wanted to join and get on stage rather than just being a happy punter like I've always been?
Well, you know, I was in a band in high school, when probably when I was about like 16 or 17, I started answering ads for like sort of punk bands. And I got in this band with the lead singer was this guy, Steve, who had been in that band, The Shirkers, who had put out a single on Limp Records. And there's this guy, Tommy Kane, whose brother was in the Slicky Boys. And this other guitar player, songwriter, Zimmer Voss, who I have no idea what became of them. But anyway, we had a band called Fingers of Shame, and we never played out. But we did record, actually. And we must have been one of the first people to record with Don Zantara, who later went on to record Minor Threat and Fugazi and all of the DC bands. But I remember recording with Don in his basement, and I was still in high school then. So that was pretty early on, but we didn't. So I was definitely trying to get in a band then, but I didn't succeed until I moved to Boston in late 79.
Yes. When did you discover your voice? When did you think, yes, I can sing?
You know, I was in the first band after Fingers of Shame that I was in a band called White Women. And I actually started out as the drummer. And then I liked playing drums, but I really wanted to play guitar. So I kind of convinced them to let me play guitar. And then for a little while, we went without a drummer. And then the lead singer, who also played keyboards, decided that she would be the drummer. And but she wanted someone else to be the lead singer. And at that point, we had gone down from like a 4-piece to a 3-piece. And the bass player, Judy, was tone deaf. So it kind of fell on me to be the lead singer. So
that's kind of tricky, isn't
it? I kind of ended up singing by default. And I never thought I had a good voice. And so I wanted to sing, but I was like, oh, I don't have a good enough voice to be the singer. And so I was, you know, content with being like the guitar player, but I was already like writing songs at that point. And so, so I just kind of fell into it with that first band.
And then after White Women, you formed, is it Dangerous Birds, which kind of then put out one single, didn't you, which was on Propeller Product Records. So so that was that quite a major step, you know, sort of going into much more of a tighter sort of unit than the White Women.
Yeah. I mean, I left White Women. They continued on without me for a while. And actually, I never did any recordings with them, but they've released a couple of recordings after I left. And then White Women used to play out a lot. So I had met a lot of musicians by then in Boston and put out the word that I was looking to form a group and was lucky enough to be able to find like three other like-minded women and did Dangerous Birds. Yeah.
Yes.
Single and an EP. We did a song on a compilation EP and another song on, we were on Propeller, on Propeller Records, as you mentioned. So we did a single on Propeller and then we were on a couple of the compilations too.
Yes, because it's kind of in the UK, it was kind of an interesting period. We had that punk scene and that sort of, you know, like most scenes, you probably sort of realize they have about 18 good months and then it all gets a bit, you know, poor. And then you got the post-punk scene with quite a lot of, you know, more interesting bands. But then sort of 82, 83, there was a which started to happen, which was the kind of more indie scene at that stage in the UK. I mean, we always had the mainstream charts, but there was also, you know, like you had that, you had in the with that, I suppose, Trevor Horn Productions sort of vibe. And we had like bands like The Smiths and the June Brights. And then there was the Wolfhounds and bands like that. Did those kind of bands kind of come over to the USA at all?
I don't remember hearing about The Smiths until probably like later in the 80s. Mid 80s. The first British bands that I really became aware of was The Maps, The Fall, Joy Division, of course, not the Maps, Swell Maps. I mean, there was a Boston band called the Maps around the same time. But yeah, the Swell Maps, the Fall, Echo and the Bunnymen, Psychedelic Furs, like the that really early stuff, Susie and the Banshees. And yeah, the Smiths I wasn't aware of until later. And what were some of the other bands that you met?
Oh, yeah, there was like, I mean, they were very kind of, I suppose, kind of indie. They were like, there was Yeah, Yeah, No. There was the Wolfhounds. Then in from Australia, you had the Triffids and the Go-Betweens. New Zealand, we had bands like the
Kills. I knew about the Go-Betweens, but to me, that was like, I didn't know about them until like the late 80s, early 90s. Like, I'm definitely a huge Go-Betweens fan. And I was a really big Birthday Party fan. Right. Got into them quite early.
And what about early Nick Cave, you know, when he sort of started, you know, with a slightly different combo after the Birthday Party? Did you sort of follow his career at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a huge Birthday Party fan. I discovered them probably in like 83 when they put out Prayers on Fire and then Junkyard and then, you know, all the EPs. They were like my favorite band. I was like devastated when they broke up. Dangerous Birds actually opened for the Birthday Party in Boston. It had to be like 83, something like that. So I was definitely already like a big Nick Cave fan. And when I definitely followed him from the Birthday Party through his whole solo career.
Yes. And then, God, you know, this decade, you're whizzing through lineups like crazy here, aren't you? Your next band is it Uzi that you sort of became part of? So did that, I mean, most people that I interview, they have a very intense period with one band and then they think that's it with music. But obviously you're sort of being able to sort of juggle or at least, you know, keep this kind of excitement going. So what was it like with this next combo that you put together or were part of?
Well, with Uzi, I was really influenced by this Boston band, Mission of Burma, they had a person, like a sort of a fourth member of the band who ran tape loops from behind the soundboard and did all sorts of really interesting stuff. And I became really interested in that kind of thing, like tape loops and sort of manipulating other sounds that weren't just sort of standard, like band instruments, you know, like guitar, bass, drums. Actually, one of the women in Dangerous Birds, Lori Green, her boyfriend at the time was Martin Swope, who was the guy that was the sound man, tape loop guy for Mission of Burma. When Mission of Burma kind of came out of hiatus again recently, and who took that role on? What's his name? I'm going to forget. It'll come to me. He used Steve Albini, and he's more known now as a producer, but he's in Shellac with Steve.
Okay.
I'm just spacing out on his name, but anyway, he
it'll come to us.
He kind of took that role over later, but so with Uzi, I wanted to do something different. I felt like with Dangerous Birds and White Women, I was kind of coming from a garage rock type place. More, I was doing like into punk and garage rock, but kind of like sort of, you know, more like sort of the rock and roll style. But then when I heard the Birthday Party and bands like that, that were really not really borrowing much from, you know, garage or blues necessarily, I wanted to start Uzi. And we had I met this guy Phil Milstein, who did stuff with a four-track cassette player, and he would sort of play this cassette player that would make all sorts of like bound tracks. And it was just a little bit more of a interesting band to me at the time. What I was interested in, I was interested in sort of like exploring a different type of music than sort of more standard rock and roll. And we ended up putting out our first and only record on Homestead, which was Gerard Cosloy's label before he started Matador. And through that, I met the people in Live Skull, because Live Skull was on Homestead. At that point, like, Homestead had Sonic Youth and Scratch Acid and Live Skull and God, who else?
There was Big Dipper as well, wasn't there, on that?
Big Dipper, Big Black, I mean, just tons of bands.
Oh, Naked Ray Gun as well.
Yeah.
That was a kind of label. Yes, it was quite the thing. So you put out Sleep Asylum. Was that your?
Yep, that was our only record, and I think we had already broken up by the time it was released.
What was the kind of the story behind the band? Did you play? Did you manage to sort of get out much and play live?
We did. We played a lot around Boston, but we didn't play out of town. Like Dangerous Birds actually played a lot more out of town shows than Uzi did. Uzi, I don't think we even ever made it to New York. We played a lot in Boston, and maybe I'm trying to remember now. I don't remember doing a lot of out of town shows. I think like Boston had a really great scene then, and like Throwing Muses were just starting. Like I remember playing with them, and there's a lot going on here. So I think I was pretty happy to stay around to play in Boston. Yeah.
Yes, because Live Skull, you joined, that was around 87, wasn't it, your sort of right, moment so with them. They had been going since 82. So what was it like sort of becoming part of a band who was sort of quite established?
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, I had been a huge fan of theirs. I was a huge Live Skull fan and would go see all of their shows. And I was like really, really big fan of theirs. And I'd even thought in my head, if I could join any band, I'd love to join this band. I mean, I was a really big fan. They didn't know that, but because I didn't really talk to them. And then some point, like, I don't know, in the year after Uzi broke up, my friends, the Wild Stairs, were opening up for Live Skull in Rhode Island. And I tagged along with them, and, you know, they were all sharing a dressing room. And so at some point in the night, I started talking to the Live Skull people, and, you know, and they asked me my name, and I have a somewhat unusual name. So I said, Talia. And they're like, Talia Zadek by any chance? And it turns out that they had been real big fans of the Uzi record, which they were on the same label as Uzi. So they had heard it, and they had really, really loved it. And they always thought that they didn't, you know, recognize my name as being like a female name. And so I have kind of a low voice. So they had always thought, and on the picture of Uzi, you can't really see my face that well. So they'd always thought that I was this like small dude, you know? And so they were just like, wait, are you you're the singer in Uzi? And I was like, yeah, I was a singer and one of the guitar players. So anyway, we met there like, oh, we love your record, blah, blah, blah. And then I heard from them a short while later, and it turned out that they were just about to go through sort of a transition with the band, and they had decided that they wanted to get a lead singer. At that point, Mark and Marnie and Tom were all sharing the vocals, and none of them really wanted to be the singer, and they just decided that they wanted a lead singer. And also, I think by then, James Lowe had kind of announced that he was going to be leaving like after the next record, like, so they were kind of like looking to change things up a little bit. And, you know, they asked me if I wanted to try out for the role. So I did, and they were about to record a new record, and that was Dust It. And
yes.
I ended up recording that record with them. I was, while still living in Boston, I hadn't really officially joined the band yet. And that was the record. I think James Lowe played drums on half the record, and Rich Hutchins played on the other half. Rich, who's still playing with them now. And and then after that, at some point I moved to New York and just kind of joined the band full time.
Yes, because this was recorded in New York. Was this, because I did an interview with Martin BC, was it, because he mixed it, did you record it at BC Studios, or
yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Right. What was your, was that the kind of first time you'd been in this studio that Martin had put together?
Yeah. Yep. That was my first time there. Live Skull had already recorded, the first two records. I think they did like three, they had already put out, when I joined them, they had done Bringing Home the Bait, which was their first LP. They'd done Cloud One, which was their second LP, and they'd done the Pusherman EP. So I came in after the Pusherman EP, and I think they might have had a live record then too. But yeah. So they had been in Martin's studio. They had been recording with Martin for quite a while then, so they were comfortable with him. But Dust It was my first time recording with Martin and recording in BC studios.
Yes. And did you, were you part of the creative process of the kind of songs that came together, or had they already been kind of written?
No, I was very much part of the process, yeah.
Right. What was the sort of the creative kind of journey for that album? Did you sort of just, you know, rehearse a lot, have it all written and then go into the studio, or did it, you know, I just wondered if the music came first?
Well, you know, it was kind of weird for me because it was the first time that I'd been in a band as just the singer without playing guitar. So I was used to writing songs like on guitar, and you know, I also sang and wrote lyrics, but I had more input into the actual, you know, melodic structure and, you know, harmonic structure. So this was my first time just where like we would jam basically, but I wasn't playing anything. So I would just sing and have a notebook and kind of like scrawl into the notebook, and they would play their guitars. So it was kind of like, yeah, just, it was all sort of written together. So I wrote all the vocals and lyrics for those songs, and those rest of the guys, you know, wrote the...
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The music.
Yes, because it's quite an intense period you had with Live Skull, because kind of basically the following year you bring out another album, which is, you know, quite fast and furious at this stage.
Yeah, they were definitely, you know, really hardworking and really matter of fact about it. They were just like, all right, we're gonna make another record. Right now we're gonna make another record. We're gonna rehearse and for, you know, 4 weeks, and then we're going to go into the studio. So it was kind of like, it was as opposed to like, I was, you know, it probably had something to do with the cities we were living in, because I was used to living in Boston, and you know, there's old houses, and you know, all the bands, we lived in houses and we had basements, and it was just a little bit more lackadaisical. And in New York, everyone lived in tiny apartments and you had to rent rehearsal space by the hour. So you were forced to be a lot more efficient with your time. So I was used to, yeah, you get a band together and then you rehearse for a year or two, and then maybe, you know, and you play out and then you write stuff and then maybe you go into the studio and record a record. But with Live Skull, it was kind of like, you know, they were like, no, this is, we're going to make this record, then we're going to go on tour, and you know, and it was great for me because it was what I wanted. Because up until that point, when I joined them, I was probably like, oh gosh, I was probably like 25 or by that time, 26, and you know, I'd been playing in a lot of different bands, but had never toured, and kind of like every band I was in seemed to break up, you know, before the record actually came out. So I was excited to be in an actual functional band that was going on the road and going, you know, touring and stuff like that.
Yes. When you came to recording, it turned out to be the band's last album. Did you have a sense that it was going that way, that you know, after that album, you know, it was going to finish, or was there no sense of that at all?
With Live Skull?
Yes.
No, I didn't know that it was going to finish. No. I don't think we had any sense of it at that time. It was kind of like during the subsequent touring around that record, like you said before, we were really putting stuff out and working really, really hard. So it was a bit of a, you know, it was like a whirlwind of like 3 years, three records, constant tours. And I think by the time we did a lot of touring on that last record, and I think I think we went to Europe first and then we went to the States. I think by the time we were touring the States, things were starting to unravel a little bit. So I think at that point, maybe I had a sense that, you know, this might be the end, but yeah, you know, there was a lot of different factors.
I would imagine. Did you, because I know John Peel, I mean, we were kind of in this country had a slight, we were slightly lucky for that scene because we had this kind of DJ called John Peel. We also had 3 weekly music papers, which, you know, had big circulation. So people got, you know, could get kind of, out there on the radar. And sort of also, as you could imagine, the UK is tiny, isn't it? But we have a lot of towns and cities that all have an alternative indie night or whatever night they have. So you could sort of get to tour. Did they have the John Peel sort of session? I was kind of trying to work out if you did a John Peel session or not with the band.
We did actually. It was the next, not the most recent Live Skull record, because you know they've kind of gotten back together, but the one, I forget which one, maybe it is the most recent one, where it's half new songs and half Peel songs from our Peel session. So we did, Live Skull did do Peel session.
Can you remember much about that? I just wonder if you can remember who it was in Maid of Vale, whether, you know, the producer was the famous Dale Griffith, who was in Mott the Hoople.
It was definitely at Maid of Vale, but I don't remember who produced it.
Yes. So because the other thing that I sort of found from doing this, and I suppose it could be more from a UK thing, that there was that period of the kind of the 80s indie world, which was from, I put it down to 83 to 87, which basically are the years of the Smiths. And then when they broke up, you know, there was a sudden new kind of musical chapter that started again. And also there was Ecstasy came along, which seemed to make a massive difference to the musical landscape. Suddenly everyone wanted that dance scene, you know, like there was the Happy Mondays, the Soup Dragons. There was also, the Charlatans, the Stone Roses. There was also all the Hacienda club nights and stuff like that. And then after that, there was the Seattle grunge scene. So I just wondered how that affected your kind of creative kind of moment during that kind of late 80s, early 90s period.
I don't really think that scene affected me. I went from Live Skull to pretty soon after forming Come. So I was already by like 90, by 90, Come had formed, and like I think we put out our first single on Sub Pop in 91 and our first record 1111 in 92. So I was not influenced by the whole rave culture at all.
Yes, my God. I mean, so you've got this great moment of being able to sort of go from the 80s into the 90s and have another decade of quite sort of solid, another solid band. So I have to say, you know, you're one of the, I've interviewed a lot of people. You've done really amazingly well on this. Most people have to drop out at some stage, but your experience with Come, that was kind of so successful.
But also, you know, like just, you know, there was a pretty big bridge between, it seemed like the grunge scene sprang out of nothing, but it really didn't, because I remember Mudhoney being around when Live Skull was around. I remember playing with Mudhoney and or going to see Mudhoney and being really into their record. And so like bands like Mudhoney and Dinosaur and all those bands had been there all along. And then it wasn't like all of a sudden they formed in the 90s. It was just like all of a sudden when Nirvana broke through with their second album, that all of a sudden this light was shown on all these bands. But those bands had been there all along and were peers of mine. You know, like, yes. I used to knew Jay, and I knew, you know, Jay Maskus, and, you know, and I didn't know the Mudhoney guys as well, but, you know, so we were all knew of each other, and we were all kind of doing the same thing, even when Live Skull was kind of ending. And then when Come started, it was kind of like, I think our record came out, like, I can't remember when Nevermind came out, but it might've been the same year Nevermind came out, like, or I mean, no, it was after, probably like a 6 months after or something like that. So
yes, I mean, during the sort of the '80s, we had Husker Du, the Butthole Surfers, you know, and obviously Sonic Youth had been about. So I don't think, you know, as a fan, you never sort of realized it was going to get much beyond that kind of.
Mudhoney were huge in the '80s.
They were huge.
Touch Me, I'm Sick. That was like 89.
Yes.
I remember listening to their second album in the Live Skull band, you know, and Live Skull broke up in 90. So they'd already been around for a couple of years and in the States were really popular. So
yes, I think it was just that when they were touring the UK, they came to the Norwich Arts Centre and, you know, and I know Nirvana came there supporting Tad, bizarrely, on a Sub Pop tour. And, you know, it only holds 250, 300 people. So it was kind of at that level that when Nevermind came out, everything kind of changed for sort of the next couple of years. So it had such a big impact, really, that, you know, during the 80s, a lot of those bands, you know, it was good, but you sometimes didn't feel like you were going to be part of that, a really popular kind of musical moment, really. But obviously, right. Nevermind changed everything, didn't it, really, at that stage. So then, yes, the 90s would come. So was that on Matador Records, you said?
Yes, that was on Matador.
And what was it like sort of having sort of come out of Live Skull and then sort of forming a new band? Because this was like completely new for all the members, wasn't it?
New in what way?
Well, the band hadn't sort of been about before you all sort of joined. I'm just sort of, that wasn't really well put. But, you know, like with Live Skull, they'd been around for 5 years before became
one. No, it was a new band, and I was excited about that. And I was also excited to be playing guitar again. I really missed playing guitar. Well, when I was in Life Skull, I always had sort of side projects that I'd play guitar. So I'd been like, me and Chris Brokaw had already been sort of jamming and playing on guitar. And I really wanted to do a sort of different kind of music than Life Skull was doing. And I really wanted to write music too, not just the lyrics and vocal lines. So I had kind of an idea of what kind of stuff I wanted to do. Me and Chris both did. And then we would talk and, you know, hang out when I was still in New York with Live Skull. And then when I ended up moving back to Boston, where he already was, he was already playing with Arthur and Sean in a different group. And that group kind of like splintered apart, and then but Chris and Sean and Arthur were still playing together, and they invited me to come down to a rehearsal, and that's kind of how Come started.
Yes. And then your first album, 1111, there was, you already got an amazing sound on that album quite quickly. I mean, and your guitar playing and the vocals, I mean, you know, it becomes something of a, not an instant classic, but there is a great amount of sort of sonic, a great sonic vibe to it. Did that kind of relationship between the two of you, was that kind of, you know, did you sort of feel it straight away that there was something quite special about the band?
I think I did. I mean, I knew, like, me and Chris had met before I joined Live Skull, actually. We had met in Boston right before I moved to New York to sort of join Live Skull full time. And we had played together, and I immediately was like, knew that this was someone I wanted to work with at some point. We stayed in touch that whole time through the '80s. So I already knew that that I really loved Chris's guitar playing and loved playing with him. And I knew Arthur because he was in this band. He was played drums in this band called the Barbecue Killers that Live Skull had toured with. And I was totally in awe of his drumming. So I was very excited to play with Arthur. And Sean, I had met before because he was also lived in Athens, Georgia, which is where Arthur lived. And where Barbecue Killers was based, but I hadn't played with him before. So I'd known three out of the four I already knew and was a big admirer of in musically speaking.
Yes. And then sort of as you sort of again sort of got to that, was it the around the fourth album, Gently Down the Stream, Did that also? Did you sort of feel that the band were sort of coming to an end at that stage?
I don't think, no. Again, it wasn't like, I'd say when we made the record Gently Down the Stream, that we, that was definitely not on our mind. And, you know, we made the first two records with, the rhythm section of Arthur Johnson and Sean O'Brien, and they both actually left together as a team after the second record. So then we had like different rhythm sections on the third and fourth record. And I think by the time we made Gently Down the Stream, we were like, okay, we're ready to have a more permanent rhythm section now. And so we were playing with Daniel Coughlin, who was the drummer on Gently Down the Stream. He was based in Boston. And up until then, we'd been playing with different people who didn't necessarily live in Boston. But we decided, you know, we want to sort of get a regular permanent rhythm section. And we never quite found a permanent bass player. So we were playing with a couple of different bass players and Daniel. And I think it was, so we released the record and did a bunch of touring on Gently Down the Stream. And I think when it came time to write another record, that's when we both me and Chris were kind of like, I don't know, this isn't really happening. Chris was doing some solo stuff already and was getting more into instrumental music, which obviously as a singer was not, I couldn't be a part of that, you know? And then he also was playing a lot with, both me and Chris, and all of Come actually, supported Steve Wynn in this record he had put out called Melting in the Dark and toured with him. And then Chris kind of continued to play with him. I played and toured with him on that record, but then Chris kind of, at some point, a year or so later, Steve was looking for a touring guitarist and Come wasn't really doing anything. We were kind of in a writing phase at that time. And Chris ended up going on tour with Steve. And it's kind of like a couple months tour turned into like a 7 month tour turned into like a year and a half tour. And it, I have to say, Come just kind of fizzled. It wasn't really like a big, you know.
Yes. But again, you did two John Peel sessions during that period, didn't you? Sort of in 92 and the following year, 93 as well.
Yeah, we did. Yep.
What was it like? I mean, you know, how did you find the kind of, you know, the European audiences compared to America?
I think they're different. I think, you know, that the European audiences are maybe in a way got us a little bit more than the American audiences. I don't know. It's just such a difficult question. I think United States and Europe are so different from each other that it's really hard to make that comparison. I mean, they're so different geographically, they're so different culturally.
Yes. No, yeah. It's, yeah. Well, I sort of, as a sort of a person from the UK, we used to get very excited about anybody from America. You know, if you could find an obscure artist, you felt, especially on the John Peel show, you felt so chuffed with yourself because there's something great to think that band was yours. And then obviously when you went to see them live, you realized a few hundred other people also had the same idea, but there was a real commitment. And I think kind of, it was the idea of the exotic or the kind of some, you know, this projection onto a lot of the American bands that we love because they were elsewhere. But perhaps if they came from your own town, you'd have thought, no, I can't be bothered with them. You know, I don't know. It's a funny attitude, isn't it, really? So that's why I think a lot of American bands often do quite well in the UK because we're just terribly excited to see them, you know, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it goes the other way too. I mean, I think a lot of American, I was always really influenced by a lot of like British bands and Australian bands and, you know, because it's, kind of like, yeah, it's not just that the geography is exotic, but also, you know, the music is different and it's kind of coming from a different place. So you're hearing stuff that you haven't maybe heard before, you know.
Yes. But then, so that was just two decades of solid music. You start a solo career for the next, for the rest of your life. So did you just have a moment where you sat down and thought, right, that's it. My next plan, my next path in life is going to be myself in the driving seat.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I mean, I think at that point, like I'd been in Come and I'd been in Live Skull, I'd been in Uzi, I'd been in Dangerous Birds and White Women. And I think like, especially with like Come, like I just felt like I didn't want to be dependent on other musicians, on other band members anymore. Like I wanted to be able to play, like I think when Come, when our first rhythm section left, like when Arthur and Sean left and we started playing with different people would be like, how can you still be Come, you know, without Arthur and Sean? And I just never wanted, even though me and Chris wrote all the material, you know, pretty much, I just never wanted to be in that position again where I felt like I couldn't play songs that I'd written because they belonged to another band. I wanted everything I wrote from then on to belong to me and that I could play it with anyone that I wanted to play and no one could ever say, you know.
Yes. Well, I can see. I mean, because your solo career, I mean, has been, you know, pretty prolific, actually, hasn't it? You probably, have you done sort of 8 albums since 2001 and various probably EPs and singles and live recordings?
Yeah. And I have another band now that has.
Excellent.
So I do have another. I have a band called E, and we've actually put out 4 albums and a single and cassette. And we put out our first 2 albums were on Thrill Jockey, and our last 2 records were on a Czech label called Silver Rocket. And we've toured Europe 4 times too, and done some touring in the States. So I've kind of gotten back into the band thing while continuing the solo thing because I do really like playing in a band. And I like writing collaboratively. I get a little tired of like writing on my own all the time. I like having both of them. So I really enjoy like coming up with songs in a room with other people at the same time. You know what I mean? We're all like kind of writing it ourselves. So E is actually in the process of writing our 5th record now. We're a trio and it's with Jason Sanford, who had a band that was very popular in the States and they did tour Europe quite a bit, but they seem to be a little more esoteric. They toured with the X a lot and it was a band called Neptune. Right. They all built their own instruments and stuff. And then the drummer is Gavin McCarthy from Karate.
Right. Yeah, dear old
and
Gavin.
Both Gavin and Jason were living in Boston at the time. Since a few years now, Jason actually lives in Colorado now. Him and his family moved there. And Gavin, as of the last record, is not going to be part of the new record. He wasn't part of the last tour, but so now we have a new drummer, Ernie Kim.
Excellent. You know, you're very good at your sort of person skills, I guess, and personnel changes here. You're able to flow with it. Did you? I was just kind of curious with that kind of creative process. I don't know if you saw that, two films. There was the Beatles film that came out a couple of years ago, the 8-hour film. Did you sort of watch in that and seeing how they came together during that month or two of putting, you know, recording a new album from scratch? Did you find that quite inspirational yourself as an artist?
I love that so much. And I have to say, I am not a big Beatles fan. Like I was never, I don't think I own a single Beatles record. I might own a cassette of the White Album, or Revolver. Did they do a record? Like, I'm just really not a Beatles fan.
Yeah.
You know? obviously I know their music.
Yes.
You know, like how can you not? But, you know, and I respect them obviously quite a bit, but, so even as not a Beatles fan, I love that so much. I found it so inspiring and so interesting to me. I'm very, very interested in seeing bands in the studio. I've always loved that Sympathy for the Devil, that Rolling Stones movie. I found that fascinating too, watching how the song started out with like as a country song and then kind of turned in. So I love that. I enjoyed that so much. I watched it with a bunch of friends. We in my neighborhood, and we watched it like every Tuesday night. We'd get together and watch a different episode. And
yeah, well, I, you know,
I was like, this is so great. Yeah,
it was good. And there was also another series that they used to make quite a bit called the Classic Album Series, and that was anything from Black Sabbath to Motorhead to Phil Collins to Simply Red.
I've seen some of those. Is that like on Netflix, or it used to be on one of streaming or something? It was just like in the studio, and it would be like maybe one or two guys from the band and whoever the producer was.
Yes, that's the one. Absolutely. They would have the tape, and they'd have, you know, the singer or the guitarist, and yeah, they would pull down, you'd hear the bass line, or you hear the kind of guitar, or you hear the vocal. And you know, it was just like, I was amazed. Even bands I didn't like, I still loved those. And I just thought of yourself as an artist, keeping that kind of enthusiasm, especially sort of making music from scratch every time, you know, how you keep that kind of energy and sort of looking for the next thing. A bit like, I don't know if you saw David Bowie, the David Bowie film last year, Moon Age Daydream, which was much more of a, I don't know, abstract kind of concept really from the film director. But again, it was kind of interesting, just, yeah, kind of a very impressionistic kind of idea of Mr. Bowie, I suppose, and keeping the enthusiasm while sort of needing to produce something at the end of it must be, you know, quite a challenge at times. And I just wondered how you yourself keep that going.
You know, I try to, like, I found kind of like through trial and error that like it's best for me to have a few different projects going, that they all kind of feed each other. And you know, it's, yeah, I just I kind of have a, try to keep a variety of different things going to keep my interest going. I mean, there's definitely been times with the, when the, you know, that I'll get a little bit, I try not to get too tired of stuff. I mean, the solo stuff is hard. Like sometimes, you know, cause I learned that I really need to have some different types of stuff, some stuff where I'm kind of in charge, but then also collaborative stuff. And I think, you know, really where I get that charge from is playing with other musicians. So I'm really, that's where it comes from. It comes from playing, making music with people, you know, like, I think, at least for me, just kind of like sitting in my room and doing everything, you know, alone in my bedroom, it can kind of get a bit claustrophobic for me. So I think to do as many different types of stuff as possible is kind of like the way to keep it fresh, you know?
Yeah, because when you did your last album, which I believe was your eighth one, Perfect Vision, this was this mostly written and recorded during the dreaded lockdown period, or had you written some?
It definitely was. When did we recorded it? I remember we finished mixing it in the beginning of 2021. So we recorded it in December of 2020. Yeah, during the lockdown. Yeah.
And how did that process work? Because again, you had Gavin on drums, didn't you? Then there was yourself, guitar, vocals, Winston on bass, and David on viola, which was exciting. Had you, you know, so when you brought that band together, had you sort of been talking on Zoom or on Teams to sort of try and work out how you're going to make that process work?
Yeah, we had been. Well, so at the time, like, Dave and Gavin and Winston, the bass player, all were living in Boston. And I also had a bunch of, but because it was like the pandemic, and I had started collaborating with people remotely, which it was, I had never done that before. And I finally got my act together and learned how to use my computer to record and trade tracks with someone. I mean, the lockdown was a big impetus for that. That's something that I always meant to do, but never got around to doing. So, you know, there was a lot of other musicians, you know, everyone was basically at home. So I, Allison Chesley, who performs under the and records under the name Helen Money, contributed quite a bit, like with cello and piano. And then I had a pedal steel guitar player, Karen Sarkisian, who that was all done remotely. And Dave did his viola parts remotely. And then me and Gavin and Winston all went into the studio together in person. So we kind of like, I did a lot of the demoing at home and set the tracks. And then I went, me and Gavin and the bass drums, guitar, we rehearsed the songs maybe for a week together in person, and then went in the studio, put down all the basic tracks, and then everything else was done remotely.
Yes, amazing. I mean, everyone learned how to use their homemade recording studio, or, you know, the software on their computer at this stage, hadn't they? There was a lot
GarageBand
of kind of
for me, but I finally figured out how to use GarageBand.
everyone suddenly made that kind of a big thing to sort of master on sort of lockdown period. So then sort of going forward, you know, from with E and this, your solo project. So the next album coming out will be with E, will it?
I'm not sure yet. We are mixing a single right now that's going to be released. I'm not exactly sure when, but probably fairly soon. We're doing it on a small Boston label, and that's going to be from some live record, a live, really great live show that was recorded in Geneva when we were touring last summer over in Europe. So that's going to be the next for E. And we're working on writing a new record, and I'm working on writing a new solo record too. And so I've got a bunch of stuff in the air, and I don't know which is going to be released first. Like, Nothing's quite at that stage yet where it's in the manufacturing.
Yes, quite. I got you.
Nothing's completed yet. None of the recordings are completed yet. But
and have you any live shows planned? Actually, you've got one tonight, haven't you?
I got one tonight. Yeah, yeah. I'm playing tonight. Solo. I'm playing with. I started taking saxophone lessons, and the guy I'm taking sax lessons from, he was like, he has an amazing band. He's an amazing alto sax player. And the band's called Fully Celebrated Orchestra. And I've been a fan of theirs for ages. And so we all have been, everyone in Com used to play with them, and someone I've known for a long time. But anyway, I played clarinet for a long time. I always wanted to learn saxophone, and recently borrowed a saxophone from a friend. I'm taking lessons now. And so he's like, oh, well, instead of, his band has a residency. So this is me paying for my sax lesson by performing at the residency. That's what he wanted in lieu for payment. But I love seeing those guys anyway. So I'm doing that, and Come is actually getting very busy, which is kind of surprising. I wasn't expecting to be so busy with Come, but like, we keep getting offered for shows, and they're really good shows. So we're doing it. We're going back to Europe. We're playing Primavera in the spring, and we're doing a bunch of shows on the East Coast in the spring. We have a couple more reissues coming out this year on Fire Records. So that's getting busy. So I'm just kind of like, I've got a bunch of stuff going on, and I'm just kind of going with whatever, letting things kind of like shake out the way they seem to want to go. So right now it seems like Come will probably be the busier of the projects on in terms of touring.
My goodness, you've got a fantastic couple of weeks, haven't you? At the end of May, early June with Come, actually.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Yes, very excited. Yeah,
I know, because one of those dates is the Colchester Art Centre, which is down in Essex, just north of London. I think that's that seems to be the go-to place for a lot of artists, because I know Jarbo from the Swans was down there just before Christmas, I believe, doing a double bill with a lute player. So obviously, you know, they've got a good booking agent down in Colchester. And then several dates in Newcastle, Glasgow, and obviously London, Cafe Otto. So I'm sure Thurston Moore will be there because he seems to live there.
We're also playing Todd's Morden and a few other places as well. I think it's like 5 shows right now in the UK, in England and Scotland. And
then Italy, Spain.
A couple in Italy. We're doing, I think, like 7 shows in Spain now. Yes. Been adding some. A few shows in France.
And the Netherlands.
Paris.
Yes.
Luxembourg, Switzerland. And then we're going to do a show in Norway at the end of the tour, too.
Fantastic. Do you find that having those kind of experiences of sort of getting out and about in a completely different world, does that also sort of give you sort of creative ideas as well, or, you know, stimulation in some way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really enjoy performing. So to me, it's like the other half of the coin. So I'm like, I like writing and I like recording, but I also really love performing and I really love touring and traveling. So I don't know if my songs are necessarily inspired by my travels. I think my songs tend to come from a more internal place than an external place. But personally, it's something that's really, really important to me. I mean, music is a performing art, and I really enjoy the performing part of it a lot. So I get a lot of it. Connecting with audiences and just that feeling that you get when you're communicating, you know, in that way with, you know, in a performance. So that brings me a lot of pleasure.
Yes. And just kind of lastly, I mean, if you could have whispered something to your 16-year-old self starting out, some words of wisdom or some sort of, I don't know, nudge in a different direction, or not a different direction, but, you know, just if you could have whispered something to your 16-year-old self, even if that person ignored you, is there anything in particular you might have just gone, oh, yes, that would have been a good idea? I mean, it could be anything, you know, from, it doesn't matter, but I was just always curious because sometimes you go, oh, yes, actually, there is one thing I'd have said to that person.
Probably, I would say, have confidence in yourself, you know. Because I feel like, you know, that's something that you need to have that I didn't really have, and, you know, kind of like, you know, I think like struggled with a lot, and you know, probably might have like held me back and stuff. So yeah, that's what I'd say.
Yes. I know, when we're young, it's we probably just all look rather offish and arrogant, but we're just in just riddled with insecurity and sort of doubt.
Yes.
It's easy to be done. Well, anyway, look, thank you ever so much. There you go. Seamless edit there. Anyway, a massive thank you to Talia Zedek to give me the time for that interview. Much appreciated. If you want to find out any more information about her career, Google. That's always my best approach. Or she's probably got various social media platform sites that she uses as well. So anyway, that's the best I can do, I'm afraid. Anyway, look, this has been the C86 Show, David East. So if you want to contact me, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just do C86 Show. All these interviews have been archived. You can find those on Spotify, iTunes, Podbeam. It's true. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe.